Okay, folks, we're going to get started. Can everyone hear me okay? All good? Okay. So it's an honor to be here and have this panel to share with you. We are all journalists, and we have all covered environmental justice in one way or another. And we're going to be talking today about just approaches to covering the energy transition and, you know, which often we think about environmental justice coverage as covering the impacts of fossil fuels, but increasingly it's also about the impacts of the solutions as well, or things that are pitched as solutions to climate change. So I just want to, you know, introduce our panelists here really quickly. I'm actually going to have them introduce themselves, and I'm going to, as a way of doing that, I'm going to ask each of them to answer a question, which is, basically, how did you get into covering environmental justice, and was there a moment where it clicked for you, where you in your reporting, you really saw environmental racism happening, where you really understood the gravity of this threat? And just as an example, I'll talk about real quick how, you know, I started covering air quality and really was exposed to these issues through covering the air quality beat in Los Angeles as a news reporter, and was covering, like, you know, air pollution from ports, from refineries, from trucks, even like animal rendering plants, and started to realize that I was going to the same neighborhoods and the same communities, sometimes the same people over and over again, who are dealing with multiple things, not only from pollution, but also from, you know, expanding industries like logistics. So that's kind of where I realized that, like, this is an assault on many fronts here that communities of color largely are dealing with. So Ollie, I will let you start off, Victoria.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much. So I think I always tell people I didn't know I was an environmental reporter when I moved to New Orleans like 2 days before the anniversary of Katrina. And so I think I really started to realize not only that there was an environmental justice issue with the aftermath of the hurricane, but then also I started to say to people years later when I was moving home to New Jersey, like, I'm done covering hurricanes, I'm sick of hurricanes, I'm finished, this is the end of that journey for me, and I'm moving back home to New Jersey, and that's it. And then Superstorm Sandy came, and I said, oh, well, maybe I'm not done covering hurricanes and climate change. But, yeah, I think, you know, covering lots of hurricanes really put into focus the neighborhoods that were most affected and that had right, the longest lag of cleanup and help. So, yeah.
And I just want to, Victoria, can you tell us your current assignment and what you do?
I'm a health and environmental justice reporter at Inside Climate News, and I am based here. Thanks, my awesome coworkers. I'm based here in Philadelphia, and people ask me, are you a Philadelphian? I'm married to a Philadelphian, so I feel like I'm a Philadelphian through him. And, you know, so I've been covering a former refinery that was the largest refinery in the nation until it closed a few years ago. And so I've been covering that community and the health effects and the environmental justice issues that come out of that, and actually a tour that I'm co-leading tomorrow is kind of featuring some of that reporting. Yeah.
My name is Leila Yunus. I am a staff writer at Grist, where I cover environmental justice, different issues. I think I've mostly focused probably on air pollution, but I'm also interested in other environmental justice stories as well. And I think what really crystallized this issue for me, I had been covering air pollution, specifically in Cancer Alley, Louisiana, for several years. When I did a story with my former colleague at ProPublica, Max Blau, on Cascade dish soap. And we basically, it was like a supply chain investigation. Can people hear me? I feel this like, okay. So I basically traced the supply chain of Cascade from the oil field to the bottle on the shelf. And throughout that whole process, which started in the Gulf of Mexico and goes through, you know, Port Arthur, Texas, piped underground to Cancer Alley, you know, in Louisiana, and then shipped up into an industrial town in South Carolina, what we kind of saw throughout that journey was, you know, each of the places that the kind of chemicals landed were what advocates and residents called sacrifice zones. And I'd never really understood that concept, but when you do a supply chain investigation in the U.S., it leads you to these communities always. And you kind of realize, oh, like this chemical ethylene oxide, which is in, you know, all of our soaps and all of our products that we use every single day, which is used to sterilize our medical equipment, well, it's all manufactured in like two plants, and they're right here in these, you know, small communities on the Texas coast, for example, or, you know, in Cancer Alley, and these people are breathing this stuff, and we all need this stuff to live our, you know, modern lives. And so, yeah, for me, it was very material. It was, oh, wow. I don't even think twice, you know, before buying these products, but they come at a higher cost to a lot of people.
Hi, I'm Melba Newsom, and I am a freelance writer based in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I've always been kind of a science, health, and the occasional environmental story for most of my career. I think what led me to this was during the when COVID first hit, I got a grant from the Pulitzer Center to report on the impact of the coronavirus on Charlotte's Black community. And that started because we keep really good data by race and ethnicity and everything, and how it relates to everything, because it from the Voting Rights Act. So we had this data, and it became clear that people of color were being impacted disproportionately by that. But then when I was reporting this over the course of months, I realized that the people suffering most from COVID were the people who lived in the worst environmental conditions. And that link became so clear to me. So then I just started reporting everything. Of course, the environment is everything. If you're an environmental reporter, you are a generalist interest reporter because it impacts everything. And then, of course, North Carolina is famous for its hog farms, right? So that is a story that has been going on ever since they, you know, came and made that a big center for where, you know, you get your bacon. But then going to those communities, I saw the environmental justice injustices were so clear there that the same people are being burdened by these industries. And every time we turn around, they say, well, we need to have this. This is good for jobs. We need to put this petrol plant here. We need to put this hog farms here. We need to do this in these communities. It is always the same communities who are asked to sacrifice their air and their water and their just decent living. They're like, well, this is what you have to have jobs. And I say, well, the people in Myers Park, which is the rich community in Charlotte, they have jobs. They don't have to live smelling hog shit 24/7. So why is it that the same people are asked to sacrifice for the roads when the roads cut through their community? Why are they asked to sacrifice for this petrochemical plant or the fertilizer plant? And that is what kind of put me on this environmental justice beat, and there's no shortage of things to cover. That's for sure.
Well, I wanted to start off, you know, asking Victoria and Layla to talk about a topic they've both written on, which is steel mills and in Gary, Indiana, and surrounding communities. I think that's a really interesting topic because it's one of these industries where we get, you know, you look back, I think in your reporting, in both of your reporting, you found communities where there was a long generational real history of those industries in this community, but it's very diminished where they don't bring the jobs that they used to. They still bring the pollution, but they don't bring the jobs. And so I wanted to know a little bit about, if you could walk us through in each of your case kind of how you reported the story, some of the, those stories, some of the sources you used, both data and reports, and then also people and how you work to build trust among communities that have really been dumped on for a long time. So.
Yes, Gary, Indiana. It was such a natural story, actually, because it's like a really quintessential American story of a place that was basically built by industry. I remember reading some history during my research, and it was like, the mills built Gary. There was a sentence that I remembered. U.S. Steel built Gary, Indiana. It was just a stretch of dunes on Lake Michigan until U.S. Steel came, and they literally built a town almost overnight. So the history of that place is absolutely fascinating. I encourage everyone to read about it. And it's kind of got that boom and bust history that you often find in these sacrifice zones, a place where, you know, at American manufacturing's kind of golden era was a booming place, really, you know, great schools. And then the jobs are shipped overseas in this, like, generational decline after World War II, you know, a place of people ultimately left behind. It's a community that is majority Black, majority low income, and a place that's kind of, you know, I think that the mills that remain are really holdouts from that era. It's like a very kind of medieval process, steel mills. And I'll let you talk more about that, but, you know, the mills haven't really changed from when they were built, you know, many, many, many decades ago. So you can imagine, we're talking about like over 400 tons a year of heavy metal pollution. Like, I think that's really hard for people to understand just how much that is. 90% of it comes from four mills right on Lake Michigan. So like imagine arsenic, lead, chromium, like chromium 6, that's getting dumped right on these people. The way that I went about it, when I say natural, like, the history was just so interesting, and it just fits so well in the story. I easily connected with kind of advocates at Earth Justice and other organizations that were working on, you know, the issue, and they connected me with people on the ground. So I didn't actually go to Gary. I'd really love to, actually. But it was really like a remote reporting process. And what the last thing that I'll say, because I really want to hear what you have to say, Victoria, is just that so little actually has to go into making these mills a lot safer. It's really like, you know, the matter of just adding a standard to put limits on the darkness of the smoke that emanates from the doors and so on. And industry is really determined to not let that happen. And I just watched a story yesterday about this, basically, where the U.S. Steel and Cleveland Cliffs, the only two companies that own steel mills in this country, they launched like this huge disinformation campaign, basically saying that standard was going to cost the industry billions of dollars and force them to shut down. They got all these senators on board, including Joe Manchin, including John Fetterman, and they wrote multiple letters to President Biden and also to, you know, Michael Reagan, kind of saying, hey, you know, don't pass this standard. And it worked, right? The new law just came out, and that opacity standard is not in there. And it would have been a small standard. It would have cost really not very much, and it would have prevented a lot of pollution. And so I think that when we talk about places like Gary, where, yeah, you know, there are industry jobs, and, yeah, the community in some way, as I'm sure you'll say, like, are attached to them in a sense, but it really is a matter of, like, I think a lot of people aren't asking for plants to shut down, as I've learned. A lot of times they just want the bare minimum protections, and that is being withheld from them.
Yeah, it's funny. When I first started helping my colleagues report on this story, we had talk to someone about a study looking at, you know, the pollution and kind of like, yeah, the caps that could be put in place. But I had just, when I moved, right before I moved back to Philadelphia, I was living in Indiana. I was teaching there at Notre Dame. And so our, like, thing that we used to do, my husband and I, was we would kind of ride through Gary whenever we would go to the airport in Chicago, you know. We would ride through Gary, and we would go see, like, the Jackson 5 house and... You know, so I knew a lot about Gary. I knew a lot about the community, and every time I would drive through there, right, it was your soul, your heart would just bottom out, because you could see where like almost the music died, right? And so when we were talking about this study, and we were talking about looking at, you know, kind of the health impacts that were going on there, right? I was like, we really need to incorporate, actually, a colleague of mine who at the time was based in Chicago, and I was telling her, like, you have to go out and you have to talk to people that are there. And a lot of families in the community, right, they move there, I mean, for various reasons, but some of them really moved there because of the Jacksons. Like they made, right? Like, they made Gary, like, they put Gary on the map. Like, it was like, you know, the Jacksons live here, right? And then, you know, a lot of the families that are there, right, like, for decades and generations of family members worked at the steel mills. So, you know, talking about the impacts of what's happened to you is a touchy subject, because, right, like my great-grandfather worked in the steel mill. My grandfather worked there. My father worked there, you know. My mom worked there. You know, like, it put food on the table, you know. And, you know, I mean, like any industry, right, like, there's also, right, like, parks and schools that were built by industry. So I think for me, when I started talking to some advocates, I was like, can we, you know, do you know anybody in the neighborhood, any families that that might be willing to talk? And it just so happened that my coworker had went there, and there was like a brunch that she went to, and she was talking to this one woman. And an advocate had connected me with that same woman, and we had like an interview over the phone that was really good, and yeah, we just kind of compared notes, and we were like, oh, we're talking to the same lady. So I was like, oh, let's circle back to her. So I circled back to her, and she was talking about, like, yeah, her whole family, right, had worked in these steel mills, and she had left Gary, but came back, and when she came back, she started noticing, you know, that her daughter was, started, you know, it was hard for her to breathe. She was worried that, she was having asthma symptoms, and she was going to the doctor and worrying about that. And so that's when like her work, kind of began, and she started to open up, like, right. And I think, like, having somebody on the ground, we were really lucky, like, having someone on the ground, and then just me just kind of really talking to her about, like, this is such an important story, you know, like, telling her about the study, but then also saying, like, look, you know, this study doesn't matter if we don't have a face, you know, if we don't have someone that we can connect it to, someone that, like, you know, people can understand, like, there are human lives behind all of this. I think, you know, when you're it's so easy to kind of throw out the numbers and throw out the names of these chemicals, but, you know, the lives that are at stake, right, that are on the line. So she was willing to open up her life to us and help us tell that story.
Well, you said something there that I wanted to draw a connection on. You talked about that the industry had, like, funded parks, and I think you said What else did you say that they had funded in the community?
I mean, like everything. No, I'm kidding. Like everything. At parks that were open, right? Parks. I think there was even like she told me turkeys during Thanksgiving, that kind of thing. Like when she was growing up.
Yeah, that seems like a common thread in a lot of frontline communities. The industries that are responsible for a lot of pollution or other impacts, they do have a whole arm that is kind of dedicated to, currying favor in the community. And I actually wanted to ask Melba about that because I know that, Melba, I was hoping that you could talk a bit about your reporting on wood pellets. And I know in one of your stories on that you talked about how that industry as well, at the same time while they're saddling the community with impacts, they're also paying for things, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The the wood pellet industry, North Carolina had the first wood pellet facility, I think, in the country. Enviva, which is the largest wood pellet producer from the UK, and they came and they located in North Carolina. But it's throughout the Southeast, but that was the first place because they get generous subsidies and they've got a lot of people saying, well, this is good for our community, this is jobs and all of this, and this is clean energy. Who was the person who said, whatever you say clean energy, you got to put it in quotes? So it's supposed to be the new wave of the future, this wood pellet stuff. Well, now Enviva is going bankrupt because it's not a business model that's sustainable, and they live off of subsidies. But they put these really polluting facilities in these frontline communities because the people they lack political power, they lack economic power, and then they tell them that this is, really good for jobs, and they're a private forest that they can come in and take over and then farm them. And it creates a lot of environment. There's a lot of negative environmental impacts for the communities that live around there. And a lot of this, the farms that they get or the forests that they get are from, black people who've had that land for generations, and it's what's called heirs property. And so this is a way that they can convince them to sell that property to us or let us farm it. And one of the things that Enviva did was really just kind of buy votes to let that keep going on. They gave donations to the black universities, like NC Central and all of this, to buy goodwill, and they would go to the NAACP banquets and, give a $10,000 donation. Okay. And to get a lot of goodwill and to kind of grease the wheels for this stuff to go through. And these people are not benefiting from that, not in any kind of way. And they tell you, oh, we're not destroying the trees. We're using tree trash, like the leftover wood. That is a lie. That is a complete lie. I went up in a plane and flew over, and when we came out of the woods over to this clearing where they were doing the tree harvesting, the first thing I said was, oh, my God, it looks like the Hunger Games. It was just devastated. Trees cut down to the, it was just nothing left. And they leave it that way. They tell you they're replanting this. So this is what I mean about this good, clean energy thing that's supposed to move us to another, to a better place. A lot of these technologies, I won't say a lot, but many of them don't deliver what they promise. And they don't talk about the downside of what it's costing these places where they set up, where they locate. And all of these are in, I think we call them in North Carolina, Title I communities or something. David, you could help me out there. But it's up, huh?
Tier
1 communities where they're very poor, overwhelmingly people of color, and they set it there, and they have to deal with the truck traffic and the tree pollution, and then it leads to other impacts like deforestation and all of that kind of stuff. But they go and get in good with people who have authority, and like they did with them, and say, oh, this is really what we need for jobs and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the same old, same old. You all know the song. You even know the tune. Okay, so that's how it works. And it's very frustrating to me that we keep getting bought out for so cheap. It's like, what was the guy's name? Donald Sterling used to give, he got a big award from the guy who owned the Clippers. He got a big award from the NAACP because he gave him some kind of donation. But he was the most racist creep you've ever seen. But he got these people on his side because he knew he had to deal with a lot of black people by being the owner of the Clippers. So therefore, let me go here and make nice with these people so they will co-sign for me and say that I'm a good guy and doing something decent.
And I also wanted, because there's obviously a connection between, you know, where those pellets are going and right what they're, and this idea that they are a renewable resource, right? So I was just wondering if, you know, that idea, the idea that this industry is being pitched as like a climate solution, does that, like, what awareness do you see of that in the community? And do you think that fuels skepticism of like, well, if this is the solution, it's got a lot of the same impacts as the old stuff? You know, like, do you think that fuels skepticism about, you know, the transition to things like other things like electrification and other things that could be viewed as the same way, you know?
Not sure if it fuels skepticism, but I think it kind of, it is part of that same thing where those pellets are not used in the United States. They are shipped to the European Union. So whatever it's doing, it is not for this community. We are not, 100% of that is shipped overseas using like dirty bunker fuel and all this kind of stuff, but it's supposed to be so climate friendly. And so we, the same people are being, even if it did work in the UK as zero emissions or whatever, it is still the same people who are asked to make the sacrifices, you know, like going in and taking resources from an impoverished or less wealthy community for the benefit of others, like what we have done, mineral and resources and extraction. And so that is the kind of thing that people are now seeing. Even if it were a legitimate clean energy source, it's not clean energy for us. We're the ones who are having to live with all the pollution and all that. It's not even being used here. So that's really creating, I think, some necessary backlash, I would say.
All right. Now, I wanted to ask you, Layla, about, you've done some incredible reporting recently on liquefied natural gas terminals on the Gulf Coast. And this is really interesting to me because it's one of these really booming industries right now where we're supplying it to much of the world. And could you, like, give us a summary of, like, kind of how you approached that story, what you found, and sort of, again, the context of that in communities that are not just dealing with other extractive industries, but also with the impacts of climate change on the coast.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so similar to what you were just talking about, Melba, where LNG is all really being produced for export. And so what Jake Biddle, my colleague and reporting partner on that story, and I did was we felt like there was so much buzz about LNG and everyone's talking about it, and it's, you know, obviously with the war in Ukraine, it's gonna, you know, be the thing that weans Europe off of Russian gas and also is gonna be kind of this key to our climate future. And there had been a lot of reporting also kind of debunking that, showing that actually if you account for all the emissions, LNG is a highly polluting industry, and that had been pretty well established. But we felt like what was missing was a real understanding of what this actually meant to the people at the sources of extraction. And that means people on the South Louisiana coast, and that means people who are actually dealing with the effects of climate change in a way that, you know, few other people in this country are. You know, these people are really on the front lines, and they're losing ground. I'm grew up in Louisiana, but I'd never been that far south. So it was really a fascinating, you know, trip for me to go all the way down, really to kind of like, it felt like, and I would encourage everyone to go, it kind of feels like you're driving a little bit to the end of the world. You know, you're driving down, at one point when you get to the end of Plaquemines Parish, it's just like one long road, kind of to the coast, right? Which we know is, and we grew up being told in Louisiana, like, we're losing this many football fields a minute or an hour. And you're like, it's like that existential dread just is kind of like always with you from a really young age. And so, yeah, so we wanted to know what this was like for the people down there. And, I really, first of all, just can't emphasize enough how just absolutely beautiful this place was. And I've always known Louisiana to be beautiful, but that particular kind of pristine, it's really some of the last kind of pristine wetlands we have in the state that these, and it's hard to understate as well, like absolutely massive, 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 massive facilities are getting dumped on top of these wetlands right at the mouth of Hurricane Alley. People described, you know, the incredible noise pollution. The roads are suddenly choked with trucks almost overnight. You know, their lives just change like in a blink of an eye. And yes, we are dealing with environmental justice communities. You know, we're dealing with multi-generational fishing families. You know, they eat what they fish. People who've kind of been living in this area for just many, many years. And the way that we approached that story was both kind of in the way that I was sort of used to, which was talking to advocates, reading all the permits, which I really recommend, understanding the clean air and water regulations that are attached to these projects, what the companies are doing to evade those rules. But then also, it was really it was a story that happened from door knocking, really, and getting in the car, going to these places, spending a couple days, just like driving around through these little fishing villages, knocking on doors, talking to people. And I did get different perspectives. I mean, this is a place that after so many successive hurricane seasons, a lot of jobs aren't there anymore. In you know, one part of Southwest Louisiana, right in Cameron Parish, you don't even have a hospital. In the entire parish, you no longer have a hospital. So these are places that, they need all the help they can get. They need the jobs they can get. But again, like I said, kind of when I was talking about Gary, I think that what you find and what these communities' concerns are, it's not that the plants come, it's how they come. It's not that the plants come, it's where they decide to set up shop. They could set up shop in a slightly different area and it would cost them a little more money. They wouldn't get the water access, but they would save the wetlands. They would save these communities so much trouble. But no, like what they're concerned about is their bottom lines, and the Louisiana government is more than willing to kind of, you know, privilege that perspective. And so that's what you see time and again is them just kind of behaving with a certain degree of impunity in South Louisiana. And then obviously the communities pay the price for that. So, yeah.
Thank you. Victoria, I wanted to ask you about, you've done some reporting on, efforts to electrify housing, public housing, and sort of some research and residents' attitudes towards things like induction stoves, you know. Could you tell us a little bit about that and maybe any lessons learned about how to cover, you know, the transition to zero-emission technology in communities that sometimes don't have the resources to do it, and even if they're, you know, or maybe skeptical for good reason of being told, hey, take this stove, it's better, I promise, you know.
Yes, and we were talking about this earlier, too. In that report, there was an advocacy group who noticed that if your neighbor had a stove, a new induction stove, that you'd be more likely to, like, try it out, right? Because, like, oh, well, it worked for her, and she could still cook. You know, maybe this isn't too bad. The funny thing about gas stoves, too, was, you know, I don't, you guys all remember, like, it kind of became very politicized last year, and, like, you know, the Democrats are going to take your stoves away from you. But, you know, the funny thing is a lot of these researchers have been studying gas stoves since the 80s and looking at the health effects of gas stoves, right? And so it was really interesting, you know, the thing that you said about this report that I looked at was there are New Yorkers who really want to try this out, but they cannot afford it, right? I mean, it seems so easy. Like, you know, if you understand the health effects of a gas stove and that it is still leaking, even when it is off, right? That's great. You know that information, but now what do you do with it? Like, you can't just up and go buy it. Right, especially if you don't have the resources. So this was like this trial thing where they put it, you know, put induction stoves in some homes in New York, in some housing. It was like a housing project in New York, and so it was just really interesting. I think some residents like wanted to just try out other folks' stoves. They were some people were worried about like, you know, the pots and pans that were passed down from generation to generation, would it work? But I think more than anything, there was this curiosity. I think we're all curious, right? There was this curiosity, and this desire to try new, right? But then, like, you know, how affordable is it for all of us, right? So, I mean, we'll see what happens, I guess. You know, I think at the end of the day, I was also really curious with talking to people who lived in public housing and kind of were, you know, kind of told about, you know, the different health effects and kind of what they thought. And there was this one guy who I spoke to who was like, okay, I know that, you know, it could be bad for, you know, my kids' lungs. But This is, I don't have the money to switch, right? And I don't have the money to move, right? It's easy to say, like, but I don't have the money to move. You know, and I thought that was just really unique. I mean, even when you talk about, I mean, not unique, but I thought it was really important to say, because, like, even when you talk about EVs, right? You know, there are people who are curious about them, who, you know, right? You know, even here in Philadelphia, curious about them, but they're like, oh, well, you know, I try to get an EV. Like, I there was a girl who I spoke to who's she's a part of a group called Black Girl Environmentalists, and she's like, I wanted to buy one, but I can't afford it, right? And so she got a gas powered car, right? So I think there's that. Like, it's like it's, you know, the change is happening, right? But, like, I think, you know, communities are worried about being left behind, and we need to be worried about that too, you know.
I should also point out that in some cases these communities are being targeted by, you know, industry misinformation, and that that applies to, you know, targeting communities of color for, you know, to support, like, you know, or to oppose bans on gas stoves, that sort of thing. And it also extends to the electric vehicle space too.
Yes. Oh, so. gas stoves are, it's the chef preferred, right? Like. Even my mother-in-law told me that when I started recording.
Yeah, I had a politician one time in a totally unrelated interview say that you couldn't cook tortillas on an electric stove. It wasn't possible. I was like, where'd you hear that?
Yes, please.
It is so true. You know, I consider myself a serious cook, and serious cooks do not use electric stoves, okay? And I was just wanting to get rid of my gas stove because it's not right, but Bobby Flay and Tom Colicchio told me that if I get an electric induction, will work just as well as a gas stove, like for cooking. I'm like, okay, so that made it easier for me to go that way. But it is a lot of that kind of thing. Even like liberals who are afraid it's not going to be as good for cooking, and the cost of that range was astronomical.
So, even you just brought a new one.
Right, yeah. So I want to be mindful of our time, and I want to open it up to questions. So what I'm going to ask you to do, just so everyone can hear, is if you want have a question, come up here to the podium and use the microphone, and again, just identify yourself and who you're with, and just leave it to questions, please. Yeah, come on up.
Hi. I'm Celeste Gracia. I'm the environment reporter at WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Melba. My question is really for all of you. My biggest concern and my biggest worry when I cover stories about environmental racism or environmental justice is that I'm going to be part of the problem and I'm going to do parachuting journalism, or I'm going to talk to these communities and then exploit their stories. And I really don't want to do that. So how do I not do that? And y'all were also, I think, Layla, I'm sorry. You were saying that when you did your reporting in Gary, Indiana, it was all remote. So I'm also curious how did you get people to trust you enough, and how did you get them comfortable enough to talk to you? Because another part of this is, like, I don't want to do parachuting journalism, but I want to make sure people are comfortable and make sure that people trust me. So I'll leave it.
I'll take a quick first pass at that. Yeah, it's obviously a great question. It's a question that should haunt us all. And I think if you're not constantly haunted by it, well, you should be. So that's my first point. But really, the way I think about it is, I always want to be offering these communities something. And what I have to offer them as a reporter who's literally getting paid to spend time researching and writing about this stuff, I can offer them information that they don't have. And I can offer it to them in a way that's not in the sticky, you know, jargony language of a, you know, air regulation. But I can actually explain to them what they're breathing, what chemicals they are, what they do to your body, what they can do about it. And so I always like to lead with information. And I've found over the years that people want that information, that that's not information that their regulators are actually giving them. So that's number one. I do a lot of investigative work, and so that helps with that, because, you know, we really are kind of trying to uncover things that communities don't know, betrayals of the public trust. When it comes to places like Gary, you know, it's always ideal to be able to be there. But of course, newsroom resources, and there are certain constraints. And even though, for example, that I grew up in Louisiana, I did not grow up in the communities that I've covered there. And so that's like, there's a real difference, you know, between, you know, me and them. And so I would consider myself in Louisiana, in the communities I report on, as like largely a parachute reporter in that way. But again, I mean, I think that what I did was I lead with information. After all these years, I have like a really solid understanding of, you know, the Clean Air Act, the regulations, the rules, the sticking points. And I just like to kind of ask them if they're aware of some of the things that I'm finding. And I do think that when I'm doing remote reporting, I'm very often speaking with the people who are already in advocacy and who are, you know, here to talk. And the last point that I'll make is that I think that it's important that we're worried about these questions. I also think that a lot of times people actually want to share their stories, and it's very clear who those people are. So I never want to be in a position where I'm trying to convince someone to tell me a story. I usually will walk away from that. But I also think that, and someone once told me this, a reporter that I really admire told me, well, it's a little condescending of us to assume that people don't actually want to share their stories as well. And I think that that's true, and I've carried that with me, and I have found that sometimes people are like, oh my gosh, you're here to ask me about that? I've been waiting for you, right? And so those are the people that I generally want to talk to, you know, who are the people who are really looking to have their stories told.
Am I supposed to stay up here? Can I go write myself?
Well, I'll just jump in. Just keen off what Layla said is that I had the great experience of being an environmental, like, air quality, environmental health beat reporter for like almost a decade, and just having the chance to go back to the same communities over and over again, even at meetings, they would see you there. It took years for people to start like, hey, good to see you, you know, like for people to really see your presence. But I would say that, so if you're able to go back to the same places, the same people, the same story, and so they know I'm not just some fly-by-night person. I'm not going away. I'm here. I'm invested. Of course, you're not going to be as invested as they are. You don't live there. You don't live their experience. But just to show that. Another thing that I would say also is I mean, this is probably a truism for all journalism, but don't go into any interview with someone in the community thinking that you know what the story is. Just say that you want to know, you know, just be open-minded, because not like, as we've, everyone has attested to, there's mixed feelings. Some people are a lot more, you know, some people who live near a refinery are like, yes, the refinery is great. They gave my kid a scholarship, you know. That's not the person that's going to be like, you know, but you just have to be open to their experience. And I think people know the difference between someone who is like essentially being another extractive, you know, journalism can be an extractive industry too. And it's just being another like extractor versus someone who is really trying to listen. And so I think that's like a big part, if I could just say that piece. But anyone else want to respond to that question?
I love that. I was going to say, that remote part is really, it can be difficult. But I love what you said about sharing the information. I think I try to do that when I'm speaking to someone remotely. And then also just being super available to them for questions before and after, right? And, you know, that they have my phone number. They can text me any time, day or night. My parents are doctors. I'm also a breast cancer survivor. So I think that I understand this kind of this idea of like your story being so personal to you, and that you know, when you open up and you share it with someone, like you want to be able to like, yeah, if you have a thought in the middle of the night, like text that person and be like, is that okay? Like, you know, how do you feel about this? Anyway, so I'm always available. But then in person, which can be hard, you know, sometimes, but in person, I'm always listening, like even, you know, and kind of like standing back, and I'm always telling people, I'm a bird, I'm a fly on the wall, like blah, 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 like ignore me. Just do your thing. One thing that really doesn't have to do with the transition, but was in covering the refinery, the former refinery here in Philadelphia. I was at like a celebration picnic two summers ago. And so I'm interviewing people and hanging out with folks, and they're talking to me about, you know, different health effects and different stories that they want me to do. And I was saying to them too, right? Like I'm here, I in the community, like I want to continue to cover your story. It's not like a one and done thing. And I was telling that to everyone. And there was someone who came late, to the picnic, and they were like, oh, this is Victoria. Like she's really cool. And so she's talking to me and she's like, yeah, girl, you know, I have PTSD because I used to live here in the community by the refinery, and it got so bad that I had to move, you know, a couple of neighborhoods away. Actually, she lives in West Philly now instead of South Philly. And I was like, oh, really? You know, so talk to me about that. You know, how does that, you know, manifest for you? And I ended up following her for a year, probably to my editor's chagrin, but really for her to open up and talk to me about mental health and climate change and the refinery and air pollution and how that all works for her, and what and talking to me about like what she talks to her therapist about, you know. And it was one of those things where like I keep saying this, but I probably told my editors too early about this story, but I am so glad that we took our time, because, right, you know, with PTSD, I didn't want to trigger her at all by, you know, asking her these questions. And sometimes, yeah, I really was like a fly on the wall, like watching her be triggered by someone asking her to do something, right, because she's an activist, and sharing her story. But like, just like, you know, just being there for her all the time. Like one time, she had no food to eat, for a week, right? And just her, like, Sonia, let's talk about it. Like, let's just walk me through it. Like, what, how are you feeling? What are you doing? Like, okay, I'm going to this soup kitchen. I'm going here, you know, and just, you know, letting her vent, right? You know, so I think, you know, as journalists, like sometimes I think that's how we don't parachute in and out, right? Like that, I think just, you know, being there in those moments, in those little moments, picking up the phone and not knowing what the conversation's going to be, but, you know, kind of like a listener or kind of like a caller who's pissed about an article, same way, like, you know, letting our sources kind of just talk and be with us. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask for another question. Anyone else in the audience? Come on up. Yeah. Come on up. And I think we're going to go just a couple minutes over because we started a few minutes late. Here we go.
Hi, my name is Wajiha. I work for Great Lakes Echo, covering climate resiliency and environmental justice, and I'm also a graduate student at Michigan State University. My question for you all is, when it comes to the energy transition, particularly in densely Black and Latine neighborhoods and indigenous lands, how can we present issues with the energy transition, like the potential replication of gentrification through green gentrification in cities like Chicago, while presenting solutions to the current industry and climate change? We heard earlier in session one to talk to quote-unquote clean energy developers and navigating fact from fiction, but my concern is reducing the voices of marginalized communities bearing the brunt of this transition. How do we as journalists confront that?
Thank you. Really good question. Does someone want to tackle that first? Alba?
We've been saying about trying not to parachute in. And I think one thing, when we have covered an issue or an area or a topic a lot, people get to know you, and so you build up a little bit of trust, so that's helpful. But I think it's also important, like you said, Layla, to go in knowing things and being able to present it to them in a common sense way. The energy transition, what I see a lot of in North Carolina, we get the same people are asked to bear the burdens of the downside of the transition. Like, for instance, the hog farm, they're talking about turning hog waste into biofuel, but the pipelines are going through the same communities again, and they are worried about that. So who's going to get the benefit of this? And it's understandable. We have the people that we're talking to have felt ignored, disrespected, you know, just mistreated. And they got a good reason for feeling that way, because they have. So I think you start off acknowledging this. And then we also have to keep pushing that other side, that stop burdening the same people over and over again. And we have to play. We can take this somewhere else. When they first started with the hog farming in North Carolina, and they put it in these certain communities, right, it's the poorest and the brownest and the most marginalized communities is where they have these factory farms. They started talking about putting one in Pinehurst, North Carolina, which is a Gulf community, a wealthy Gulf community. I will tell you, that guy probably didn't even get the words out of his mouth good before they said, hell no, that ain't happening. And so it's always the same people, and we need to put that, you know, to say, this road could go like 3 miles this way. Why does it have to come through Durham? It's a historical community. And I think that's our part, too, to talk to put that out there. What are the options for this? Is this the only place, and why is it always a tier one community? And say, yeah, we need this energy transition. Climate change impacts all of us, but it does not impact all of us equally. And the solutions should not be borne disproportionately by the same people.
I appreciate it. And just in the interest of time, maybe if anyone else wants to address that, let's just do it in like one sentence. Anything else?
One sentence. Also consider the kind of economic underpinnings of the transition in sort of like a zoom out way. Just acknowledge that in your stories. You know, this is sort of the green growth narrative is something to think about here.
And I would say that the unique perspective we have as journalists is that we're going to tell the good and bad of anything. So we get to talk about all the horrible things that the fossil fuel industry does, but we're also going to talk about the challenges and the problems with the solutions, you know. So just think about like electric cars or something. It's like, yeah, you know, you can highlight the problems as a way of looking for more solutions. So I just think that there's not, and that's something that really only journalists are going to do. Not a lot of other interests are going to do that. So thank you so much for your question. Thanks, everyone. Let's give a round of applause for our panelists. And I'm sure, and we'll all stick up here for a few minutes to, in case anyone wants to connect afterward. Thank you.
Another 5-minute break, and then we'll have our last panel of the day. We'll start at 2:15.
Yes, I know.
In New York, too.
I'm surprised someone's from Fulton, from North Carolina. I kind of felt like I was part of it. It was great. Through Friday night.
How was that visit?
It was great. Yeah. She's so up and was so excited about it. So she was great touring her around. You know, had a couple of reporters that were out there, so you know, it was good to kind of, you know, keep telling that story.
So, I'm really glad you're here again.
Definitely.
I think it's even
bigger than last year. I remember when you booked it, was like, oh, hotels are no problem, travel's no problem, but this year, like, really, things starting to kind of tighten up, so I'm glad. More turnouts, better.
We're going to hear about Sandy's grandfather. Yeah, I would have loved to have met him.
That's real. That's cool.
I'm sure I'll bump into you later, too. All right.
Oh, well, I'm actually from Central.
Oh, nice.
From Alexandria.
Oh, nice. Where are you from?
Technically, I guess. You gotta let go.
I can't. My whole thing is.
That's fair. Okay, that's fair. Okay, yeah. All right, never mind. That's funny. Yeah, life is seeing you. Yeah, reach out anytime. I wish I had, like,
I thought so.
Great panel, Tony. Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know.
Sweet. Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, a great panel.
Thank you.
Alrighty, I think we are ready to get moving on the last session of the workshop, last session of the day. So, I hope everyone got a little stretch, got a little, you know, not sitting in the chairs for too many hours in a row. But this is going to be a fun one. I think it's a good note to end on because it's very forward looking. First things first, my name's Julian Spector. I'm a reporter for Canary Media, which is a nonprofit news company covering, the technologies and businesses and policies of the energy transition. And we're here today to talk about beyond wind and solar. What's going on beyond wind and solar? And before I introduce our excellent panelists, wanted to explain why go beyond wind and solar? Because I think for a lot of people, those are still alternative energies, you know, they're still up and comers and, there's a perception that they're kind of not ready for prime time yet. But, got a little pop quiz for you. Does anyone have a guess for what percentage of the new power plant capacity getting built this year will be solar? So, like, of all the new megawatts of power plants coming online across all the different types of power plants in the U.S., any ballpark guess of what the U.S. government thinks solar will make up of that? Anybody? Anybody? 50? That's a good one. It's actually higher. Yeah. Anybody? 55? It's 58%. Is solar getting built this year? So it's actually a surprising year where energy storage is the second biggest chunk of that pie chart with 23%. So that's like lithium ion batteries. There's actually only a little bit of gas getting built. So 4% of the new megawatts are gas, which is, you know, gas is still the biggest source of power in the U.S. But what's getting built now? Wind and solar are crushing it. So we're here today to basically say, okay, let's assume the solar continues its dominance. It's kind of like
it's in a good place. What are the other technologies we really need or would like to have to round out that very challenging task of decarbonizing the grid and expanding it to cover buildings and vehicles and ideally chunks of heavy industry and the kinds of things we heard about at lunch. So we've got an excellent panel of people who spend all their time reporting on these future technologies and trying to sort out what's real and what's dubious and give you a sense of that. So we have Casey Crownhart from MIT Tech Review, Justine Kalma from The Verge, Kat Clifford from Cypher, and Michelle Ma from Bloomberg. And this is exciting for us because we've all been reading each other's stuff for a while, and it's our first time like actually getting to meet and compare notes. But our goal for today is we want to give you a lot of takeaways for like specifically how to approach reporting on these kind of complicated emerging technologies. And we'll start at more of a high level how we think about that task, and then we'll get into the four categories that were promised in the description, which are hydrogen, advanced nuclear, long duration storage, and carbon capture. And we'll try to give you some very like specific questions to ask, specific reasons for skepticism or angles of attack when you're trying to figure this out. Because really the task is there's a lot of promising stuff out there. We can't be reflexively down on everything because, then you're not necessarily finding new solutions that are needed. But at the same time, there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of people paying money to kind of pump up their technology and get more venture capital. And so we're trying to thread that needle of accurate and, forward looking, but not credulous, I suppose. So let's start that off with high level. How do you approach the task of reporting on technologies that don't really exist yet or don't exist at a meaningful scale? And I want to hear from each of you kind of what your first principles are in tackling a story of this nature. What advice do you have from your years of reporting on this for folks who might be newer to the task? And maybe we want to start with Casey and we can go down the way.
Absolutely. Hello. Can you hear me? Is that on? Closer. There. Hi. Reporting about new technologies can be really fun, but it can also be really scary because there's a lot out there that is probably not going to work out for one reason or another. I think some of the rules are the same as what you would say about any reporting. Don't be afraid to ask dumb questions. There are no dumb questions. I think also reporting on technology is really interesting and a little bit different from science reporting in that there are so many different angles to these things, whether or not the science of a solution works out, whether or not the economics of a solution works out, whether or not this is something that incumbents would be willing to adopt. So I would say we can talk a little bit more about this. I think everybody has stuff to say about who to ask questions to and what kind of sources you should be asking. But I think coming at these solutions from all of those different angles and just being really smart about the questions that you're asking can be helpful. I also just love to ask my outside sources what to ask companies or people who are proposing these solutions, just because you might not even know what the most relevant questions would be or what the challenges might be. So that's something that you can always ask somebody outside of the company. What's important here? What might be the challenges? And then you can put that to the company. So yeah.
Yeah, so I actually started doing this kind of reporting from the lens of environmental justice. I was an environmental justice reporter at Grist before I became a reporter writing about climate tech at The Verge. And it can seem like kind of a jump, but it really wasn't, because the first time I started hearing about things like carbon removal and carbon capture were from environmental justice advocates that had very legitimate concerns. And so I came onto this beat trying to understand what those concerns were and trying to better understand what this technology is. And again, kind of building off of the last panel, which is really awesome, just thinking about what information can I bring back to these communities to so that all of us can better understand where our energy comes from. Knowledge is power, literally, in this scenario. And then another piece of my background that I think informs my work in a way is that I one of the early beats that I covered as an environmental reporter, and particularly within environmental justice, was the pollution from e-commerce and warehouses. And I grew up in a community that was ground zero for this, like an inland port community, or they call it a dry port, basically where all these warehouses are built so that when stuff comes off of the ships, it gets sorted out and sent across the country by rail and truck and whatever. And I also have an uncle who, you know, who worked, he lived and worked on a freight ship and died quite young of cancer. And I wonder about all the pollution that he was exposed to being in this industry. And I lived near a port as well where there was a really big Filipino community and Pacific Islander community and Filipino. And so that's all to say that for me, it's really important to look at supply chains and impacts of supply chains. And so now, for me, the most important thing to do when scrutinizing a new technology or a new company that's offering a solution or making really big sustainability claims is to look across that entire value chain, which is a value chain is a little bit more of that industry jargon. But it's looking at everything from the supply chain to the actual how does this thing work down to waste and end of life, right? So you might be familiar with something similar when it comes to, say, like a company's carbon footprint. You know, it's best to look at all those areas as well. And so applying that same lens to these types of new technologies, whether that's hydrogen or direct air capture or whatever, it's really important to look at, you know, what are the raw materials that they're using in this? How are they getting that? And then really, really important for me, and I'm not an engineer, but I try my very best to understand the basics of how this technology works. And so that means I'll talk to the company CEO, but if he or she or they can't answer technical questions, I'm like, give me someone else to talk to. Give me your engineer, your scientist. I try to talk to outside experts as well for their view on, you know, independent take on this technology. And then again, looking at waste when it comes to things like when it comes to like carbon that's been captured, waste from nuclear reactors, all of that is really important for me to scrutinize. And then the last note I'll give is when it comes to looking at who is an expert on this, I think that people in our role as media, you know, we're best served taking a broader view of who is an expert. It's really important to understand that people who are in the communities most impacted by these technologies or the histories of these technologies are experts in their own lens, and that CEO who's just telling you about what their technology isn't the person that's like sitting there next to where it's being built, right? And so that person is also an expert in their own way. And when you do that, you'll start to see, and I think this has already kind of come up today, is that these technologies they're divisive, and there isn't I think it's healthy to give space to that. I think as, you know, reporters who covered climate change, we can also avoid the kind of false equivalency and track down the real kind of, science behind this. But at the same time, it's also important to note, like, you know, there is a history of bias even within science and research and who has been considered experts. And so it's just really important to question all of these things.
That's a great tie-in with, the previous panel and how you can carry that forward into even analyzing these future technologies that are just now getting built. So thanks. And Kat, what's your top advice for our audience here?
Yeah, well, I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me. And I'm also really a huge fan of all of the work of my co-panelists. So, like, I'm fangirling up here just having a chance to sit next to these reporters and learn from them as well. So I just want to say that. So I come to, I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay,
come
a little closer. Yeah. I came to covering climate tech from a startup and innovation entrepreneurship background. So I covered the startup and innovation ecosystem for, 12 to 15 years before I specifically focused exclusively on climate tech and innovation. So I've sort of always been covering the technologies that are sort of at the forefront and edge. I think some of the reason that I'm interested in telling those stories is just because as a journalist, I find them incredibly interesting. Anything that is inherently divisive is also going to be very interesting and fascinating. And so I think I'm interested in these areas, not only because it's the area that I have come to this topic. I've come to this topic of covering climate tech from an innovation background, but they're also just fascinating stories and fascinating places to do reporting. And I think one of the things that I've learned in covering climate tech in particular is that these are new and developing industries, so there is a lot of really wrong information out there, and there's a lot of really wrong information in the media. So I think one of the things that I have really taken very carefully and seriously is addressing some of those wrong perceptions that are very pervasive. And I think that means for me what Justine was just saying about sort of going to if the CEO doesn't understand, something or doesn't have an answer, I'm always asking to talk to the chief technical officer, the chief scientist. So I think getting sort of working backwards and starting with the scientists, starting with the innovators, starting with the engineers that's sort of just how I approached covering these topics. And then I would say the other thing, so understanding what are the biggest misconceptions, which there are a ton of, and what are the biggest, how do you sort of start from the first principles, talk to the scientists, talk to the engineers, talk to the people who understand how this thing is made. And then the other thing that I wanted to say is it's also really important, I think, from the perspective of covering these technologies and the potential for them to make an impact on emissions reduction on a global scale is to understand the economics of that. And so I think not only understanding like how something is made, but how much it costs, how much it costs now, and how much it will cost in the future. Because a lot of these technologies are exponentially too expensive right now to matter at scale, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be covering them because of the potential for the cost to come down, because of roadblocks that exist now but that don't exist, the problem that they're solving in the future makes it worth addressing and covering the technology now, even if it is too expensive. But still, you need to acknowledge those economic runways. How is this going to make sense? Because if it isn't cost effective, it isn't going to scale. And for climate, if it doesn't scale, it doesn't matter. So I think understanding the science, understanding the economics, and understanding the misconceptions, and I heard you say bias, and I think that's really important. A lot of these technologies have a lot of inherent and built-in bias, and I think it's our responsibility to kind of come back from some of that bias and ask the first principles questions.
So I wrote down a bunch of tips to make sure I wouldn't forget anything. But I think what Kat said about resting on the science is maybe the most important thing for our beats. I'm not a scientist. I don't know if any of my other panelists have like a science background, but I don't. I was an English major in college, and I got into journalism, like I'm sure a lot of you guys did, because you enjoy writing and talking to people and telling stories. But don't be afraid of that, because I think I was really intimidated when I started covering this beat, because I thought that was a weakness of mine. And I think you can think of it another way, because, my audience, at least, I'm not writing for Nature. I'm writing for people who are generally smart, interested people in the business community, most likely, who also don't know or understand this. And if I'm writing to them the way that the scientists are talking to me, they won't get it either. And if I don't understand something, that probably means that they wouldn't understand something. So it's actually a strength that I can, you know, rest on my ability to communicate and also ask these scientists to, you know, okay, that doesn't make sense to me. Can you re-explain that? And then put it in a way that, you know, the regular world can understand. That's actually a strength, and a lot of science communicators don't do that. So if that's your background like me, don't worry, you should still be doing this. We need more people like that. I think Google Scholar is your friend. You know, sometimes you talk to these companies and they'll tell you all these things, and then you're like, okay, how do I understand more about methane-eating microbes? I don't know anything. Just type it into Google Scholar. Find, you know, a scientist somewhere at some university who's written a whole paper about it. Reach out to them. A lot of these papers are behind paywalls. They will send you their papers if you email them. They'll talk to you about it. And they'll tell you the things that the companies aren't telling you about. You know, okay, these are great, but it's really hard to grow them, you know, in the lab. It's really hard to do this. And, like, you need to ask them about, like, you know, this, X, Y, and Z, how they plan on doing that. And I think another thing is there's a lot of different types of scientists out there. So a lot of the companies that are, you know, innovating on the stuff right now, they have a lot of engineers. They have a lot of mechanical engineers, chemical engineers, but they might not have an oceanographer on staff who is analyzing what the effects of spreading all of these crushed rocks into the ocean are. They might not have a biodiversity expert on staff who is looking at, like, okay, what happens if you sink all this kelp into the ocean? What is that going to do for the marine life? So make sure when you're thinking about talking to scientists, you're not just thinking about, like, okay, I've got a scientist, check, but the type of science that they're doing and, you know, the implications. Because I think, similar to the tech industry, I think a lot of, there's a lot of criticism of the tech industry, and, you know, they don't, in their curriculums in college, they're not teaching them ethics and they're not teaching them philosophy. And these are all important parts of being a good practitioner of AI or technology. I think a similar thing is kind of happening in climate tech right now. There's a lot of really, really smart people working on this stuff who, you know, are very ambitious and very confident in their solutions, but they might not be looking at every kind of effect of what they're working on. And so you need to be asking those questions yourself. And then the other difficulty, I think, of this beat is that it's very, very easy to find out what the positives are of the technology because, you know, the company startup CEOs will tell you, their investors will tell you, and then you're like, okay, great, 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 this sounds too good to be true. And then finding out, like, okay, what are the potential downsides? What are the bottlenecks? What are the challenges? What are the potential side effects and consequences of this? That's the hard part, right? That's the hard part of this job. And so to get around that, I have a couple of techniques that I rely on. One is asking these companies about their competitors and asking them, okay, so who else is out there that is doing this and why is what you're doing better than what they're doing? Because then they're much more willing to talk about that, right? Like if you're talking to a sustainable aviation fuel startup and they're making a startup, they're making a SAF based on, you know, like a new type of carbon-based sustainable aviation fuel, electrolyzer-based sustainable aviation fuel. Like, ask them, okay, why is this better than, like, a biomass energy-based SAF? Like, and they'll quickly tell you, oh, like, you know, there's limited land availability and resource availability for the biomass that they're trying to get to make this fuel, and there's just not enough out there for this SAF that we want. If you ask a biomass SAF person, they'll say, oh, well, you know, the new type of, like, electrolyzer-based SAF, like, this just requires too much energy. There's so much energy, and there's not enough energy, and it's too costly, and it's just not going to work. And so that's kind of, like, one way to get around it. Another one is investors. I talk to a lot of venture capitalists because these people, it's similar to what Kat said, like, they're putting money into this. You know, it's not just out of goodwill or, like, you know, they care about the environment. Like, if they're actually investing money into these projects, that means that they've done the work and they've done the research. But not necessarily, don't obviously ask them about their portfolio companies because they're going to be, like, saying all the great things about the portfolio companies. But maybe you can look at their portfolios and see, oh, it's interesting. This VC firm has not invested any money in direct air capture. I wonder why. And you can say, hey, you know, I've noticed your portfolio, you don't have any, like, DAC companies. Like, why is that? And they'll say, oh, we just think DAC is a complete waste of time, and here's why we think DAC is a complete waste of time. And that's kind of another way to go about it. And then another thing is, again, like, going back to the whole, you know, I don't really have a science background thing, I really try to rely on the scientists. And what's great about this new age of climate tech, like what I call like climate tech 2.0 or whatever, is there's a lot more organizations and groups, investors, collectives, also like sort of groups like Carbon Direct and Watershed that are sort of like collecting, evaluating these companies and these offsets and whatever, because they want to package them and sell them to other people. And a lot of these places, I would say Frontier is one that does this for carbon removal, and a lot of like VC firms now have PhDs on staff who are on their investment team. Look at these organizations that are vetting these companies that have PhDs on staff and who have a very rigorous way and like transparent way of how they evaluate these startups, and they usually will say on their websites, like, you know, these are the criteria that we look for when we're evaluating a startup. We're looking at durability, we're looking at costs, whatever. And these startups typically have to submit really extensive plans to these companies in order to be considered, things that we might not be able to see because they're, you know, kind of private information. So whenever I see, or like ARPA-E is another agency that I always like kind of look for. It's a Department of Energy agency that is really well known for backing moonshot projects. And so whenever I see, okay, ARPA-E has backed this startup, it's not like a necessarily, okay, automatic checkbox, but it's like, okay, well, that just shows me the kind of like rigorous evaluation they've gone through and someone's decided this is worth it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love the point about you can be sort of the stand-in for the reader by not being the subject matter expert, because that, and then you can always put it on the reader, you know, like, I get what you're doing, absolutely, 100%, but my readers, you know, they're not as sharp as this guy right here, so maybe if you could explain it for them, and then you break it down a little more. Well, I think that's a great high-level grounding, so I want to jump into the specific technologies to, you know, give you some tangible questions and lines of inquiry for covering these things. And I think, dealer's choice, let's start with the long-duration energy storage. This one's very dear to my heart. I know also Casey is a huge fan of you know, covering this and asking the tough questions on these things. So I guess we should probably define that term. I don't know if that's like in common usage yet, but the idea is, you know, all these lithium-ion batteries getting installed now, which are, you know, 23% of the new megawatts added this year in the U.S., typically are commercially viable for like 4 hours of storage. So you have your megawatt capacity that they can inject in the grid instantaneously, and then the megawatt hours is kind of like the volume in the tank, and what's commercially viable today is usually you can have enough lithium batteries to keep going for like 4 hours, 5 hours, which, you know, is great for shifting solar into the evening, but it's not going to get you all through the night, if that makes sense. Like, if, you know, a gas power plant, you can run 24/7 if you wanted to, and batteries can't do that in an economic way yet, which gets back to Kat's point of, you know, technical capabilities versus commercial capabilities. So that's where these long-duration storage companies are coming in and saying, we're going to invent a totally new battery that's super cheap for hours and hours or days and days of storage. And, yeah, in case you want to kind of ground us in that market and you know, what excites you about covering that and what are some good questions to ask if you're tackling a novel battery company.
Absolutely. I love that you cut to the heart of that, too, because I think there's a big misconception that lithium-ion batteries can't store energy for long periods of time, but it's not true. Like you said, it's an economic issue. There are lithium-ion batteries in your phone and your laptop. If you don't use your phone, it's not like your phone is dead the next day. It's just that these batteries are still relatively expensive, and so building a bunch of them to store energy for, you know, days or weeks is just not really viable, because batteries are giving you value when you're using the energy in them. And so when you can divide the cost of a battery over a lot more use cases, that's when it kind of starts to make economic sense. So like Julian said, most of what we do for energy storage today is lithium-ion batteries. They're kind of like the incumbent in the industry just because they were developed, and that's kind of the best tech that we have, because these were developed in like the 90s for like camcorders and have made their way into computers and phones, and now electric vehicles run on these batteries. So they're just kind of like the default. But really we need, A, stuff that's a lot cheaper, and B, there are some concerns about the safety and kind of long-term durability of lithium-ion batteries. And so we're seeing a lot of development, a lot of startups coming up with all these newfangled ways of storing energy. I'll mostly talk about batteries, but there are also ways to physically store energy. I know you've covered some very fascinating ones.
Some wild, stacking enormous blocks into it's not a good idea, but people have raised a lot of money to do some very sort of dubious things.
Yeah, we need to talk about that company after this. So all of these new battery companies are trying to come up with a cheaper way to store energy for long periods of time. What I will say about batteries, just like in general, with all technologies, I would argue, there are always or almost always trade-offs. So if you have a cheaper battery, there's probably something else that you're giving up. And so in the case of things like iron air batteries, that's a really popular option. Iron is a very, very abundant element, and so you can get these batteries super, super cheap. The reason we don't use iron batteries for anything is because they're super duper heavy. Like, you wouldn't cart around a phone with an iron battery in it. It would be absolutely infeasible. It would be awful. But that doesn't matter so much, maybe, if you're talking about huge installations to store solar power for, huge, huge parts of the grid. And so that is kind of one leading contender that's very buzzy. A lot of people are talking about these different kinds of iron batteries. Most of them also don't use the same kind of liquid that's in lithium-ion batteries that can present some of the safety dangers.
Meaning fires?
Fires. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
Those are bad.
We don't like battery fires. But you're giving up other things. You're giving up probably what's called the efficiency of a battery, the round-trip efficiency, which means just like how much electricity that you put into a battery are you going to get out of it. There's differing opinions about just how important that is for long-duration energy storage.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, like if you write down one thing to always ask about for a long-duration battery, it's the round-trip efficiency. Some of them are really bad. Like 50% or 40, like, yeah. You only get back 50% of the energy you put into it, which sounds terrible, but they tend to argue, like, we made it so cheap to store all that power that we can afford to kind of throw away a bunch of it and it'll be fine. And that's probably an untested hypothesis at this point.
Yeah, but that's absolutely the argument. The other one is lifetime, that we don't, for some batteries, this is maybe less the case for some of the tech that's being considered for long-duration energy storage. Just how long it's going to last is a really, really important question. And for these new chemistries, I love accelerated aging testing. Like, this is one of my most nerdy niche interests, is like, how do we tell how long a technology is going to last without waiting 30 years to see, like, how well does this battery work out? So lifetime is a great question to ask. We covered efficiency, energy density for, like, other applications. So that's if you're talking about batteries for, like, electric vehicles or something more so. Those are, I think, the big things that I would say. And then just, like, cost. Lithium-ion battery prices have dropped by, like, between 80 and 90% just over the last decade. And so anything that says that they're going to compete with lithium-ion batteries needs to kind of be cheap and probably have a pathway to get way cheaper. I think that's hit most of the high points.
That's
anything
awesome.
I missed?
Yeah. No, I think that was some excellent stuff. I was curious if anyone else on the panel, did anyone have thoughts on long-duration storage or any other ones to add on that? Battery guru,
Just to add really quickly that other ways of storing energy, physical energy storage, so actually how we, most energy storage that exists today is in the form of pumped hydropower. Just pump water up a hill and then you let it flow through a turbine and that generates electricity. And so some systems try to kind of do this, but using different materials or kind of trying to like borrow this idea. So Julian mentioned like picking rocks up and then letting them fall back down to generate electricity is kind of one thing, or like going down mine shafts with them, or like pressurizing water. So there are these kind of funky like physical energy storage systems. That's where the energy density of those and just like the mechanics of building them, energy density actually starts to become an issue when you're talking about cement blocks.
And that's also a really important point, is the pumped hydro which is, you know, a century old technology. It's very simple. It's like lift water up a hill, store it there, let it roll down through your you know, basically a hydropower system to get the power back. And that's still like 95% of the storage on the U.S. grid today. And there is a dynamic, I think, in these future climate technologies where you're, a lot of venture capitalists are really excited to like invent a better version of a thing we already have that works really well. And you know, pumped hydro is great. Like you can store many more hours in one of these big old reservoirs than, the high tech lithium batteries can. But you know, hard to build large water systems now with modern environmental regulations, which are good, you know, good to have. And so we haven't actually built any new pumped hydro in something like 30 years. And a lot of developers are trying, but it just hasn't happened yet in the kind of modern market system for the power market. But I think that's a great one. So let's say, speaking of venture capitalists reinventing legacy technologies that already seem to work fine, let's go to advanced nuclear. So we obviously have nuclear is about 20% of the generation in the U.S. right now, but these are like big, big old school plants, and we're very bad at building new ones because of cost overruns and price, you know, doubling over the course of the construction. So maybe, Kat, do you want to take point on the, like, what's going on in advanced nuclear and what do we need to know about it?
Yeah, so the nuclear industry is trying to reinvent itself with these smaller micro-nuclear reactors. And, you know, the biggest issue with nuclear energy, well, first of all, maybe I should back up a second. Nuclear energy is emissions-free energy, right? So it is base load, which means that it's always on. It doesn't have the intermittency issues of wind and solar. There are no greenhouse gases emitted when you are generating electricity energy with nuclear. And so that has sort of brought nuclear back into the conversation after, you know, we had like a big interest in nuclear in sort of the 60s and 70s. There were some really high-profile accidents and disasters, and also at the same time, natural gas became really cheap. And so you had some bad disasters and a lot of, you know, negative sentiment around that. And then you also had natural gas become really cheap. So all of those reasons, that's a elevator speech version of a complicated history, but nuclear sort of came out of favor, and we really stopped building nuclear reactors in the United States. But as we have embarked on this energy transition looking to decarbonize globally, nuclear has sort of become part of the conversation again for clean energy because there are no greenhouse gases emitted. The issue still remains. You probably have heard that the Vogtle plant, we've only built one reactor in the United States since I don't know exactly when. I'd have to look that up. I think it's probably in one of my stories. But for a long time, and the Vogtle plant had tremendous cost overruns and blew a lot of budget problems. And so that is one of the large reactors. So that's sort of one of the typical conventional kinds of reactors that we were building in the 60s. 70s, it's a more advanced model, but in terms of it being a large nuclear reactor. So going forward, right, we have a demand for baseload clean power, and we have an industry riddled with a ton of public relations problems and a few real high-profile bad disasters. And so they are trying to reinvent themselves as a solution to the decarbonization problem. did the energy transition, and the answer to that has been in large part on the fission side, which again maybe I should have said that at the beginning, but I'll get there in 1 second. So on the fission side, the answer to that has been these small modular reactors, and that's really where the hope for the nuclear industry in the future in the United States, and there are other countries that are continuing to build the very large nuclear reactors that we are not building here in the United States anymore. But in the United States, the effort is and focus is on small modular reactors. And the answer there, according to people who are, you know, proponents of small modular reactors as an avenue for the nuclear industry reinventing itself to decarbonize our future, is that they're cheaper. So that the solution with smaller modular reactors, you're trying to bring the cost down. So there's also a whole lot of other sort of new technological benefits and changes. So you're not creating the smaller versions of the reactors that had meltdowns. So I think that's really important for people to understand that these are smaller, which is an effort to answer the cost overrun question, and they also have a various new technological designs to avoid the kinds of meltdowns that have happened in the past and which derailed the whole industry by and large. So I think when reporting on a new nuclear technology on the fission side, maybe I'll take a brief pause here in my description to say that there's two kinds of nuclear energy. There's fission, which is the conventional kinds of nuclear reactors that exist today. So these large reactors, the one that was just stood up in Georgia that had huge cost overruns and deadline overruns and is a poster board for all the ways which nuclear can be a disaster in terms of meeting time and budget goals. And that is, you're splitting the atom, right? The other kind of nuclear energy that is a part of what I've been covering for a while is fusion. And fusion is you're using a lot of energy to bring the atoms together, and that fusion is where the energy gets released. Fusion does not exist. You know, there are no operating fusion reactors on Earth right now, right? So this is real far future kinds of stuff. But there's a lot of money and a lot of effort going into fusion reactors from a lot of, investors who might be considered investing on sort of the forefront of the climate tech sector. So there is money going into fusion reactors, but to be clear, there are no fusion reactors that are delivering electricity to the grid today. But
and if you had to guess on that, in a decade, like it's sort of people joke about it always being a decade away.
I know. Yeah, I know. Well, so, and yes, absolutely. Everyone is always joking with fusion is 30 years away. It's always 30 years away. It's always 30 years away. Well, I mean, so there are, there's a Commonwealth Fusion Systems outside of Boston I visited. I think it's largely considered in the United States one of the fusion companies that is the furthest along and most likely to, deliver electricity, to commercialize their fusion reactors. And they're saying early 2030s. You also have, so there's, with fusion, there's, and I hesitate, I wonder if I'm getting too nerdy here, but with fusion, there's really two main ways that fusion reactors, that they're trying to commercialize fusion. And one is with a tokamak, so that's sort of this large donut-shaped device, which is how they control the plasma. And that's the kind that Commonwealth Fusion Systems is building. That's the kind that there's a large multi-billion-dollar initiative in France, the ITER fusion project. That's, many countries working together. And that is also with a tokamak. The other kind of fusion reactor you have is with lasers, and maybe a lot of you have seen headlines. I think it was last year. Time sometimes gets a little last year?
December 22. Lawrence,
okay. Thank you. Lawrence Livermore National Lab, their lasers reached ignition, which is this key milestone in fusion, whereby the whole idea with fusion is you're going to have to put some energy in to begin the reaction, but then you're getting – you want to get more energy out of the reaction than you put in to begin the reaction. There are other kinds of fusion reactors. There's one in speaking of the timeline question that you asked, there's one called Helion. Actually, Sam Altman of OpenAI has put like $350 million into that company, and that's in Washington State. I visited their factory, and they have a power purchase agreement from Microsoft to be delivering energy to the grid with their fusion reactors in 2028.
Wow.
But you know, that...
Good for them.
It takes us longer to build a transmission line in this country than, you know, they're saying they're going to be online. Now, I can't tell you right now if they're going to reach that, but they do have that power purchase agreement. It is the sort of more risky or less conventional approach to fusion. So for nuclear, I think they're, you know, first, are you talking about fission? Are you talking about fusion, right? And then if you're talking about fission, I think the most important things to ask are, you know, how are you going to get your costs down, right? So how are you producing this? What are your supply chains? Who are your customers? And then also, especially important for nuclear, is regulatory issues. So how are these more small modular reactors, which, again, a lot of the future hopes for the nuclear industry in the United States in particular are resting on the potential for these smaller nuclear reactors, how are you going to get approval with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, that's the top watchdog in the U.S.? And then for fusion, I think the questions you need to ask for fusion are what kind of fusion are you pursuing? You know, you need to kind of get that. That's your sort of your baseline, right? Are you tokamak? Are you using lasers? There's another kind. I don't know about it. But, so is it lasers? Is it tokamak? And then, again, similar question with supply chains. You know, so I think a big key issue for Commonwealth fusion systems was getting sufficient quantities of the superconducting tape. So how are you going to – what are your supply chains? How are you going to get what you need to I think those are some big questions for nuclear.
Yeah. Oh, that's a lot of food for thought. I think that regulatory part's a huge bit, because none of the new ones have actually gotten permitted fully by the NRC, right? Is that
– I don't think so. But they – you know,
they have a – yeah, it's like halfway, right? Yeah. I think NuScale has, like, a license to construct, but not a license to operate, I think.
Okay. I'm so glad I have better colleagues than me up here. But,
so there's...
Not completely.
And I think the advocate, you know, people who are pushing for modern nuclear are very frustrated with the pace of the regulatory, you know, because obviously you don't want to rush things and put out an unsafe technology when it's nuclear, but, you know... I think there's been a lot of erring on the side of safety and going slowly, and not so much on getting new stuff approved. But
that's why the regulatory hurdle is really important for nuclear.
Yeah. So speaking of timelines, want to keep us moving to get to our last few ones and then get to questions from all of you. So let's do carbon removal. And I think Justine and Michelle have covered different aspects, because this actually covers a whole bunch of different buckets of technology, but want to break down sort of some aspect of the carbon removal category and what have you covered on that front?
I can give an overview and you can talk about one of the major categories. So I also want to just say on like the nuclear and long duration energy storage and a lot of the other technologies that we write about, the reason we're writing about it and the reason that people are investing in these technologies is because of the intermittency question, right? Like wind and solar, there isn't wind all the time, the sun isn't shining all the time, But if we want to transition to 100% clean energy, there are a lot of processes and things happening in the world that require 24/7 energy. You know, data centers need energy to be running all the time. You know, facilities that produce cement and steel and a lot of industrial processes need dependable clean energy. And so, you know, one solution is batteries. One solution is clean energy that is doesn't have the intermittency issue like nuclear, like geothermal, et cetera. And then there's also some startups out there working on ways to make those processes more able to be variable and not have to run all the time. So these are just like that's why this is all so important. But, okay, beyond this, so everyone knows that we need to reduce carbon emissions. Everyone knows that we need to bring CO2 levels down and greenhouse gases down. That's a given. But the science is also very clear that if we want to limit warming to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius, which at this point is very ambitious, we're going to have to pull massive amounts of emissions from the atmosphere, historic emissions that we've already emitted, because there's just too much out there already. This is a really growing area of interest, and it's also a really controversial one. And it's controversial for a lot of reasons. I think one of them is the fact that the oil and gas industry is starting to get involved in this space, because they have a vested interest in you know, continuing to do what they do. And I think one thing we want to make sure the distinction between, because I think a lot of people get confused, is there's point source carbon capture, and then there's carbon dioxide removal, and there's direct air capture. These are all lots of different terms, but point source carbon capture is when there is carbon dioxide that is being emitted from, you know, a point source, like a power plant or a reactor or something, from a smokestack, essentially. And you install a piece of equipment, or you retrofit that equipment and facility to capture the carbon before it is emitted. And then what you do is you inject it underground, or, you know, controversially, some oil and gas companies are taking that carbon dioxide and using it to do enhanced oil recovery, aka get more oil out of oil fields. So that's really controversial for very good reason, right? Like, a lot of people view it as a reason, as a way for the oil and gas industry to continue perpetuating its own existence. And they're pouring a lot of money into it. And the other reason it's controversial is because it's been around for quite a while. It's not, like, really that new. And it hasn't really worked. And it's very expensive. So I don't really write that much about point source. I don't think Justine does either. I think both of us focus more on carbon dioxide removal and carbon capture in the direct air capture sense, which is a form of carbon dioxide removal. And carbon dioxide removal takes many, many forms. And I can give you a quick rundown of some of the different forms that I've come across in my reporting career on this. And every day there are new startups coming up with a new way to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And I would say they range from basically accelerating, because the planet already removes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. There are natural carbon cycles that occur every single day, like trees taking carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And then there are companies that are basically trying to, they're seeing a way that the planet already naturally takes in carbon dioxide, and they're just trying to accelerate that process. So that's one end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum is, like, companies that are trying to literally just create these giant fans and suck carbon dioxide out of the air. So basically, I can give you kind of a run of show of, like, some of the different methods. There's one called enhanced rock weathering, where you take basically crushed rocks like basalt or olivine, and you spread them over agricultural fields. And I can go into the details of how that sucks carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, but it does. It's a chemistry process. When it rains, what this naturally occurring process basically takes in carbon dioxide. There's ocean alkalinity enhancement, where you're kind of doing a similar thing, but instead spreading those minerals in the ocean, or alkaline substances in the ocean, to seawater to accelerate the ocean's natural carbon sink. There's soil carbon sequestration, where you're basically doing things to soil to increase their uptake of carbon dioxide. There's even a company out there who's trying to grow and sink large amounts of kelp into the ocean, I think I've mentioned before, and that's another way of doing that. That is, again, all of these methods are very new, very controversial for various different reasons. Bio-oil sequestration. Bio-oil is when there's lots of, you know, agricultural processes that have waste, wood and timber, for example, like, you know, or waste from, like, corn growing corn, and then you take the corn husks, and, you know, ordinarily the wood waste or the corn husk, whatever the agricultural waste is, it would just decay and release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So some companies are taking that waste and then burning it and crushing that and then spreading that to prevent it from, you know, again, decaying and going up into the atmosphere. Or they're turning it into bio oil and then injecting it underground to, again, prevent that from going into the atmosphere. And I think...
These are sort of wild. Like, these all seem kind of magical.
Yeah, they are. Rock dust and... The good news, though, is I think reporting on all these technologies, I kind of go about doing it the same way. Like, they're the same... I think similar to what Casey was talking about with batteries and how you kind of... There are several, like, metrics that you evaluate batteries by. There's no, like, one, you know, silver bullet batteries that's going to be the best battery. It's the same thing for carbon dioxide removal. There is no silver bullet solution that is going to be the cheapest, most effective, most durable, least effects on the ocean or the natural resources. Like, it's really a case-by-case basis. And you have to ask these questions around, okay, how much land does this process require? Do you have to grow, you know, something, and it takes up a lot of land? We don't have that much land mass, you know, available for this. How much energy does this take? You know, is this a really energy-intensive process? Where are you going to source that energy? Is that energy, obviously the energy has to be renewable energy, so you're competing against a lot of other processes that require renewable energy, and, you know, you have to think about that, and also the cost of that energy. And then the resources required. Like, what are you sourcing to do this? And, like, how much do you need? And where are you going to get it from? And what's the impact of that? And then cost, obviously. And then technological maturity is another one. I mean, similar to fusion, a lot of this stuff, they're just ideas. They don't exist yet. You know, maybe they built a pilot plant, and it's sitting in, you know, it works in perfect laboratory conditions, but has it been released out into the real world and, like, you know, been weathered by the elements and all this stuff? And then... durability is a big one, and durability by that is, you know, I think these solutions all exist on a spectrum. You know, I think the reason, and like Justine will talk about this, I think a reason a lot of people are interested in things like direct air capture is this industry claims that they're very, very durable. Like this carbon that they capture and then they pump underground, it can stay there for millennia, and that's huge because you don't if the carbon gets released again. If it's damaged, if, you know, it doesn't work, then, you know, you spend all this money and it didn't work. So how many years do they claim that this will last? And then I think the most important thing is something we call MRV in this industry, which is measurement, reporting, and verification. You know, unlike solar and wind and energy and all this stuff that we report about, you can see when there are solar panels built and you can, you know, see batteries. But you can't really see when carbon dioxide is... you know, taken from the atmosphere. Like, it's a very, like, intangible process. And so in order to make sure that these are real things that are happening and that, like, this actually is happening, how do you measure that? How do you verify that? Are there third-party auditors coming to, you know, take, like, look at your equipment that you're using to measure carbon dioxide levels? Like, you know, with soil carbon sequestration, like, how do you measure the amount of carbon that's stored in the soil? Like, that's a really difficult thing to do, and that's part of the reason why, you know, some people are against these approaches. So basically all these approaches are different, like, are different on these scales. So some are way more expensive, but they promise, you know, much easier measurement and reporting and verification. Some are really, really energy intensive, but they don't have a resource burden, you know. And I think something really important that I want to mention, too, is, like, you have to think about the impacts that these things, these processes are going to make on local communities. I mean, similar to the previous panel, like, all these people that we talk to every day, a lot of these people, they have PR firms, they have, you know, teams of people who... their job is to get our attention, right? And so you have to think about who doesn't have a PR firm who's going to be affected by this, and how can I get their take on what's being done here, and, like, how can I talk to those people, and how can I make sure that they're part of this conversation too, and their voice is included.
That's awesome. Well, I want to bring in Justine on that.
Yes.
And then I think we're coming up soon to the end of the hour, but I want to try to do, like, lightning round of hydrogen and then get questions, and then we can kind of let people go off, but stick around to ask more questions to us if you want to. I didn't want to shortchange the audience questions. It's a lot to cover, you know, four different groundbreaking, transformative technology categories in 1 hour. a little ambitious, maybe. But yeah, Justine, what would you add to that?
So I'm really excited to get into the tea of the drama of direct air capture right now, which is kind of where you're starting to see a lot of action, especially in the U.S. And sometimes when I report on this, I'm like, eating my popcorn like I'm watching a reality TV show. Like, did that just happen? And like, oh, who just walked in the room? This is wild. So that's me as a nerdy climate tech reporter.
That might be the first time I've heard director capture described in those like Bravo terms, but
I'll explain why.
Yeah, tell us more. Wow.
Okay. So again, I think it's really important to try to understand as best we can how these technologies work on a fundamental level, because that can help you scrutinize them better. So first, to define direct air capture. Thank you, Michelle, for saying that. This is not carbon capture and sequestration. You know, this is not those devices that, like, pull carbon dioxide from, a smokestack or a source of pollution. This is taking CO2 out of the ambient air. So you're ostensibly trying to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And there are two sort of major types of technologies. And again, it's helpful to understand what kind a certain company is using, so you can better understand what some of the pitfalls they might face are and what some of their advantages are as well. So you have direct air capture that uses either liquid solvents or solid sorbents to bind to CO2, to capture CO, to absorb CO2. And so you can think of the liquid solvent, liquid DAC, being passing air through some kind of chemical solution that's going to absorb the CO2, and then it's sort of like solidified in a mineral or a pellet, and then you heat that up to very high temperatures to extract the CO2 back out and then do with it what you will. But it's no longer in the atmosphere. And then when you have a solid sorbent system, that is more like a filter process to filter out CO2 from the air. One of the big companies that uses this process is Climeworks, and the way that they've helped me try to understand this a little bit better is that their sorbent or their filters are kind of like a base which attracts CO2, which is mildly acidic, if that's helpful at all. And then that CO2, and then the filter you have to heat up again to very high temperatures in order to release the CO2, which can then be piped to, you know, wherever you need it. So that's the next piece of the puzzle that's really important, is what is done with the carbon dioxide once it's been taken out of the atmosphere. So initially, companies like Climeworks sold it as a product to be used in greenhouses or, you know, to make fizzy drinks. But if you want to make a real dent in atmospheric CO2, it has to be permanently stored away, right? So generally that's thought of as being stored underground, mineralized as stone or put into, old oil wells and things. And sometimes used to push out more oil, which I'll get into a little bit more later. Okay, so why do I talk about how this works? Again, to help you understand what some of the pitfalls are with this technology or any technology. So again, you have to heat up that filter or those